Next, we're going to hear from author Eric Schlosser, who has a new book, Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market. He spoke last April at the UC Santa Barbara Arts and Lectures Series in Santa Barbara, California.
Well, thank you. I think I'm going to make this a little bit of a religious sermon tonight. I was asked at dinner about my religious beliefs and how that connects to my work. And earlier this week, I gave a talk at a college campus in North Carolina, and I was really surprised that it was being held in the chapel, because this book is called Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the Black Market. And I didn't want to be disrespectful of this really nice Baptist chapel, but it's kind of hard to talk about most of what I write about in such a place. So I try to think about religion, and I try to frame some of it in religious terms. And since religion seems to be entering almost every aspect of our public life these days, maybe I'll jump on that bandwagon. So think of this as my version of a sermon. I'm going to talk about the black market, which is the subject of my book, and a couple of aspects of the black market. The black market is interesting to me not for its sensational aspects, and sex and drugs and cheap labor certainly are sensational subjects, but I'm interested in the black market for what it says about the rest of the economy and this country. It's easy to see the underground as something separate and distinct, and I define the underground as all those economic transactions that are unrecorded, unreported, or somehow in violation of the law. So it's nice to think there's this underground that's over here, and it's separate, and everything else in the economy is just hunky-dory and wonderful. But in looking at the underground, I'm really trying to understand the mainstream. And in the beginning of the book, I use a kind of New Agey metaphor to explain the connection between the two of them. And in my mind, it's like the yin and the yang, and how the dark and the light are actually part of one thing, not a separate thing. If you want to know somebody, really know them, you can't just rely on what they present to you, the public face that they give to the world. If you really want to know someone, it's just as interesting to know about the kinds of things they like to keep hidden, the kinds of things that they may have tucked away in a drawer, maybe more revealing than what they're putting on their resume. And sometimes it's very disturbing when you look in that drawer. So I'm trying to make people see what's happening, see what's going on. And this underground, by definition, is a world that's been deliberately hidden. These transactions are deliberately kept out of sight. And again, I think that they are extremely important. I mean, we all know about Intel and Microsoft and Disney, and that's the mainstream economy that's constantly celebrated and trumpeted in the mainstream media. But there's a whole other economy, a big one, a huge one, and to me, it's just as American and just as revealing about who America is at this moment. Now, the underground has been growing, which I think is also significant. And according to some estimates, it's doubled in size in the last 25 to 30 years. It's huge. A conservative estimate would be that the underground is about 10% of our gross domestic product. So that's about $1 trillion a year. It's enormous. When the IRS did a study in 1998 of people who were evading taxes and how much was being evaded, they came to the conclusion that about $1.5 trillion in income was being unreported. And that doesn't include criminal activity. So the conservative estimate might be $1 trillion, but who knows? It's huge. It's gigantic. Now, we've had periods with large undergrounds before, but nothing like this. Nothing like this. And I think it's very, very significant. In my book, I write about three aspects of the black market. I write about marijuana, which is a black market commodity, enormous commodity. Some people think it's America's largest cash crop, and we're the biggest agricultural exporter in the world. I write about illegal immigrants in California agriculture, and that's black market labor, which used to really be confined to California and parts of Texas, and is now expanding throughout the United States. And I write about hardcore pornography. And hardcore pornography is interesting to me because it used to be completely a black market commodity. I mean, 40 years ago, it was very, very hard to find. There was very little money in it. It was controlled by nonconformists and bohemians and organized crime figures who didn't make huge fortunes from it. And today, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. And the companies that are making money off of porn are very familiar companies, like Sheraton and Hilton and Marriott and the big satellite and cable companies. So I end the book looking at hardcore pornography as a case study in how a black market becomes a mainstream corporate market. So the lines between the mainstream and the underground are not permanently fixed. They're fluid. And people often go back and forth between the two of them. Some of these underground activities are relatively innocuous. Paying your babysitter in cash would be something in the black market if she never reports the income. There's not enormous harm in that. But another sort of black market activity would be cooking methamphetamines in your garage. A little bit more serious activity. Now, what's the religious aspect of this? Well, let me start out not by promoting any religion, but by attacking our current state religion. The state religion that we have is in many ways the subtext of this book. And that state religion, which tonight I want to attack and tell you is a false god, is the free market. Is this blind faith in the free market that has governed our political culture for the last 20 years. And when you suggest that there is something wrong with this religion, it's amazing, and I've learned it in the last few years, how quickly you're attacked, how un-American you're accused of being for suggesting that a fraud is being perpetuated, and that the free market exists truly only in economic textbooks and economic writings and in the propaganda that's being put forth by many people today to protect certain interests. I start out the book by examining what is at the heart of this free market theology. And it's the work of Adam Smith, a brilliant man, a great economist. And Adam Smith believed that in the marketplace, you saw the true fulfillment of democracy. You saw what people wanted to buy being perfectly matched by what other people wanted to produce, and therefore creating the ideal price. And it wasn't just the fulfillment of democracy, it's the workings of God. He talked about the invisible hand. It's the hand of God matching what people wanted to buy with what other people wanted to sell. And this belief in the pure free market is what we've been told about really for the last 20, 25 years. And much of this book is intended to raise questions about that theology. And I'll just start out by saying it is a myth. It's kind of like the Tooth Fairy and Santa Claus. There is no free market. And maybe some of the things I'll say tonight will suggest by the end that you'd agree with me. So the first thing I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to skip the hardcore porn tonight, but there's no shortage of it available elsewhere in this town. I'm going to talk about marijuana, and I'm going to talk about illegal immigrants and their exploitation in this state. Actually, not very far away from where we are tonight. And there's a connection between these two subjects, I think. And the connection is this theology of the free market and how it's applied and how it's not applied. Now, just out of curiosity, how many of you have smoked pot? I have to tell you, that's slightly higher than national average. Now, it's remarkable, though, when you look at people aged 18 to 25, college-age kids in America, about 54% have smoked pot. And that's significant because pot is illegal everywhere in the United States under federal law. There is no amount that is legal to have, and it doesn't matter whether you're using it because you're an AIDS patient to get rid of, to help with your appetite, or if you're a cancer patient trying to get rid of nausea. It doesn't matter. It's illegal everywhere in the United States. And yet over half of college students have smoked it. Now that means by definition that over half of Americans' young people are criminals, people who have been involved in criminal activity. This raises a question about the free market. Here's something that millions and millions of people not only want, but buy and indulge in, and yet the free market doesn't allow it. The government, this government that we have that uses the free market to justify all kinds of things, is willing to intervene in this market very, very aggressively. And under federal law, you can get the death penalty for a first offense, nonviolent marijuana crime. And in my book, I write about people who are serving life without parole for nonviolent marijuana crimes. And it's very, very interesting to me in this free market society that the government would be willing to impose these kind of penalties and these punishments. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that, and then I'll segue into illegal immigrants. Now, in the interest of total candor, because you've been so honest with me, I will say and admit that I have smoked pot. I have. And I did inhale. And I did it more than once. And I liked it sometimes. And sometimes I didn't like it. But the relevant fact is that I am not now a pot smoker for a variety of reasons. And in writing about marijuana, I swear, I am not writing in order to promote the use of the sacred herb. I'm not. And I don't believe that marijuana is the source of salvation and beauty, and I'm not a hemp advocate. My interest in marijuana is much simpler. It's a civil rights issue in my mind. It's a basic, basic civil rights issue. And it's also, to me, very interesting to look at marijuana, to look at the economics of this industry for what it tells us about our society and its dominant economic theory. Now, I said that I don't use marijuana, but again, in the interest of total candor, I will tell you that I use a much more dangerous recreational drug. And I use it regularly, 3 to 4 times a week. And that's alcohol. Alcohol is a poison. It can kill you. It can kill you if you drink too much of it in one sitting. And people die every year in the United States from alcohol poisoning. Of all the psychoactive drugs, it's one of the deadliest. And the reason it's so deadly is in order to get the desired effect, you have to consume a large amount of something that's toxic. So, people die of alcohol overdoses every year in the United States. And more importantly, the long-term effects of drinking a lot are incredible. Alcohol damages many, many vital organs, from your brain to your heart to your kidney to your liver. And as a result, every year, over 100,000 Americans die from the long-term effects of drinking alcohol. And perhaps a quarter, maybe more than a quarter of all suicides are linked to alcohol. It's incredible. Almost half of all violent crime is linked to alcohol. Two-thirds of all domestic abuse linked to alcohol. And since we're on a college campus, I think it's important to note that 90% of the sexual assaults in the United States on college campuses are linked to alcohol consumption. This year, 70,000 young women on college campuses will be sexually assaulted because of circumstances involving alcohol. So this is my drug of choice, but it's a dangerous drug. If you become addicted to alcohol, the withdrawal can be absolutely horrible. So that's alcohol. How does this society handle alcohol? Well, you can buy it at the gas station and then get behind your wheel and drive, the wheel of your car and drive off. You can be watching sporting events on TV that also have a very large children viewership, and there will be very, very well-produced, entertaining beer ads that children see. So alcohol is socially accepted, widely available, relatively inexpensive, widely advertised, yet a serious, potentially dangerous, deadly drug. And now let's talk about marijuana. And I'm not encouraging anyone to smoke pot. A lot of the pot that is out there is very, very strong. It's a powerful, strong drug. And I'm not telling anyone to smoke it. But it is much less toxic than alcohol. Now, the people who should not smoke pot are people who have any history of mental illness in their families, particularly schizophrenia, pregnant women, anyone with a heart condition, and young children and preteens should not smoke pot, because marijuana, if it does have harmful effects, is most likely to harm people whose immune system and entire systems are developing and growing. So those people just shouldn't smoke pot. And if you smoke a lot of pot for many years, logic would tell you it's not going to be good for your respiratory system. But short of that, it's amazing how harmless marijuana is. And I'm going to read you what the Canadian Senate had to say about it a couple of years ago. Quote, "For the vast majority of recreational users, cannabis use presents no harmful consequences for physical, psychological, or social well-being in either the short or the long term." It's a pretty clean bill of health. "In addition, there is no known fatal dose of marijuana. Nobody has ever died from a marijuana overdose, although I know some people who have tried. And I also know some people who have been convinced they were about to die after smoking. And it can definitely induce paranoia, but the odds are you're really not going to die. There is no known fatal dose for this drug." That's remarkable. Scientists have estimated that in order to die from a marijuana overdose, you would have to smoke 100 pounds a minute. This is true. For 15 minutes. So it just can't be done. In addition to being remarkably non-toxic, marijuana has been found to be useful as medicine. And again, I'm not going on the word of some New Age crystal holistic practitioner, but again, the Canadian Senate and that other left-wing organization, the British House of Lords. What's unusual about both of these institutions is the members of these legislative bodies have their jobs for life, so they don't have to use cheap political rhetoric on this subject. Both have found that marijuana has usefulness as medicine. as an appetite stimulant for AIDS patients, as an anti-nausea agent for cancer patients, as a drug that prevents muscle spasms in people who have multiple sclerosis, as a painkiller that has many, many fewer side effects than the powerful opiates that are being routinely prescribed to people. So you've got this drug that is relatively non-toxic, and it has medicinal uses. And how do we treat it in this society? Well, as I mentioned before, it is illegal everywhere in the United States, and some of the punishments are just incredible. In the book, I write about this hippie biker who, for his first marijuana offense, nonviolent offense, got life without parole and was sent to Leavenworth Penitentiary, maximum security prison in Kansas. I'm writing a book on prisons. That's one of the scariest prisons I've ever been in my life. This guy was sent there for pot and incarcerated alongside international terrorists, serial killers, bank robbers. It's incredible. In the book, I write about Larry Jackson. Larry Jackson got life without parole for less pot than would be in a small roach. And it wasn't even in his pocket. It was on the floor of his motel room when the police came in. And in one of the most incredible stories, I write about James Montgomery. James Montgomery is a paraplegic. He smoked marijuana to relieve the phantom pains from legs that no longer work. He had never been arrested for any crime, never accused of any crime. He was busted with 2 ounces of pot that were in the pouch on the back of his wheelchair. And he was given life plus 16 years. Now, when you think about that, the 16 years are really cold. I mean, that's like somebody's perverse idea of a joke. To give a paraplegic life plus 16 years for taking medicine. Now, the government tried, under the drug forfeiture laws, to seize the home that Montgomery lived in with his widowed mother, but was unsuccessful. And why did he get the extra 16 years? Well, he had a pipe, and there was a gun in the house. It was a handgun, unloaded, that belonged to his late father, who was a police officer. So James Montgomery got life plus 16 for 2 ounces of pot, first offense. He is not in prison today, however. And he's not in prison, I think, because the prison authorities in Oklahoma didn't want him. When he was sent to prison, he developed a life-threatening infection, very expensive to take care of him, and they just didn't want him. They were embarrassed by this. So James Montgomery is a free man. But it's unbelievable the power that the government can now exercise over people it doesn't like. If you're convicted of rape in the United States, you can expect to spend about 6 years in prison. If you're convicted of murder, convicted killers in America spend on average 11 years in prison. And I've found cases, it's hard to know. There may be dozens, if not scores, of people serving life sentences or sentences equivalent to life sentences for marijuana in this country. So the first part of my book tries to answer the question, how does a society come to punish someone more harshly for marijuana than for killing somebody with a gun? And what you should keep in mind is the life sentence may be an extraordinary and unusual sentence, but even for small amounts of pot, it's remarkable how your lives can be changed. For getting busted with a single joint, you can lose your driver's license, you can lose your car. For somewhat larger amounts, you can lose your house, definitely can lose your student loans. If you're convicted of a marijuana felony in this country, which would be an ounce of pot or more in most states, an ounce of pot's about the same amount of pot that there is tobacco in a pack of cigarettes. For an ounce of pot, you can't get federal welfare benefits or federal food stamps anymore. If you're a convicted child molester or a convicted murderer, you're still eligible for food stamps. So there is something going on when we have this drug that is a powerful drug but relatively non-toxic that has these kinds of punishments involved with it. And it's so widely used, and we believe in the free market. So why is there not a free market for marijuana? And what I learned through my research is that the laws that we have on marijuana really have very little to do with the plant and almost everything to do with the people who have smoked it over the years. Marijuana was brought to this country by poor Mexicans, and it was associated with them, the killer weed. Fear of Mexicans became fear of their favorite drug and harsh laws against it. Then it was smoked by poor blacks, and particularly by jazz musicians. Now, the predecessor agency of the DEA was the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, and Harry Anslinger ran it for decades, much like Hoover ran the FBI, and Anslinger hated jazz. He did. If you read what was being said about jazz in the 20s and the 30s, it's like what's been said about hip-hop for the last 20 years. It's a corrupting influence on the youth. It's a threat to the nation. So Harry Anslinger, as head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, decided to wipe out jazz in America, and he had a scheme to do a nationwide roundup of jazz musicians who smoked pot and therefore strike at this new form of music. But it was unsuccessful. And it was unsuccessful because his agents were unable to infiltrate the jazz milieu. They just couldn't pass. So jazz endured, but after jazz and jazz musicians, it was beatniks in the 50s, and then it was hippies who were very, very terrifying. And then there were members of the hip-hop community today. And again, you see with marijuana laws really targeting people who the mainstream fears or just dislikes. That explains the laws on marijuana. And it's remarkable to me. I went to a conference the other day for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. And I spoke to this conference. And as I was looking out at the crowd, much like I'm looking out at you, I started thinking, this is the enemy in the eyes of the government? Because I then talked to a lot of these people. The people at the normal conference were the most laid-back, gentle people you can imagine. The idea of any of them posing any risk to any of you is absurd. And yet, people like that are being crushed and destroyed by our government. The drug testing regime that we have in place right now isn't designed to find out if you're stoned on the job, because the blood tests and the urine tests can't find out if you're actually stoned. The metabolites of marijuana can stay in your body for days after you've smoked a joint. These drug tests are designed to find out if you're the kind of person who smokes pot. And if you're the kind of person who smokes pot right now in this country, you cannot work for most of the Fortune 200 companies, almost all of them. You cannot work increasingly in government. And it's a way of imposing conformity and uniformity on this society and denying basic civil rights to people who are, for the most part, harmless people. Now, how is this justified? When you look at the history of the marijuana prohibition, again and again, it's justified on moral grounds. It's wrong. It's wrong to smoke pot. Now, we used to have that about alcohol during Prohibition. And it's interesting that alcohol use was very much linked to Irish-American immigrants who were Catholic and despised. And a lot of the fuel for Prohibition came from that anti-Irish sentiment. And there were enough drinkers that we ended Prohibition. But again and again, you see this as a moral crusade, and even from people you wouldn't expect it from. Liberal politicians have played a central role in the war on drugs. Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill played a central role in the 1986 anti-drug abuse legislation that brought us mandatory minimum sentences. Senator Joseph Biden, another liberal, has been a staunch drug warrior and introduced legislation a few years ago targeting raves. Raves that were threatening the youth of America. And under Senator Biden's anti-rave legislation, glow sticks were going to legally become drug paraphernalia that could get you in prison under federal law. I'm not making this up. Now, we have had one president who's admitted having a joint in his mouth, and that was President Clinton. Our current president, I would bet you did, but he won't talk about it. Now, President Clinton had a joint in his mouth, but he made very clear he didn't inhale, and it was in England, so it didn't violate American law, and on and on and on. But what's interesting about President Clinton, our first pot-smoking president, baby boomer president, more people were arrested for marijuana crimes under President Clinton than under any other American president, perhaps twice as many as were arrested under Richard Nixon. So this war has been waged by liberals as well as by conservatives. And I'm going to read you this quote from probably the most liberal left-wing member of Clinton's cabinet, because this expresses the dominant view of marijuana. This is Donna Shalala, probably the most liberal member of the Clinton administration. Quote, "Marijuana is illegal, dangerous, unhealthy, and wrong. The government has the right to ruthlessly intervene in the free market and has been doing so, unbelievably interfering with what people want to buy and sell on moral grounds, moralistic grounds." Now I'd like to talk to you about illegal immigrants and their role in the economy and what's happened to the people who are the poorest people in this society over the last 20 years. And it's happened in the name of the free market. Now, when it comes to workers in this country, oddly enough, the free market is supposed to apply. So I find whenever I bring up in argument with my free market friends the issue of minimum wages, they'll say, well, that's such a nice idealistic idea. But minimum wages, they violate the free market. If a worker wants to negotiate his own wage with an employer, why should the government have anything to do with it? Interesting. Same is true for overtime laws. You know, if someone wants to work 10 to 12 hours a day and they want to set that up with their employer, why not? Unions. Well, that's such a nice idea, worker solidarity and everything. But unions interfere with the workings of the free market. They distort the labor market. And what if a worker doesn't want to be in the union and wants to negotiate his own wage? Now, I write about migrant workers in the book because migrant workers have been the poorest workers in America for over a century. And it's in California, where we are right now, that a labor model of exploiting illegal immigrants and recent immigrants was perfected in California agriculture. And I write about that. But I write about it not just to point out what's happening here, but to point out the implications for the rest of the country. Because what used to be unique to California agriculture is now widespread. And you see the same thing being done by other industries in other states. And in many ways, if this isn't stopped, I see this as a very good indicator of what life in America will be like in the next 20 years. And it's not a very happy picture. Now, keep in mind that migrant workers are the poorest, most exploited workers in society, but there's only been one moment in our history when there was widespread national outrage at how migrant workers were exploited. This was after a great book was written about the subject, beautiful book, The Grapes of Wrath. Now, what's interesting about The Grapes of Wrath is it depicts the only brief period in California history in which the migrants were white. And that's when people became outraged. There was an 8-year period in this country, in this state, where the migrant workers were white. As soon as the Great Depression hit California, all of the Mexican farm workers were driven out of the state, and replaced with the whites who were coming here from the rest of the United States. And then when the Second World War began, and there were good jobs in the defense industry, and people enlisted in the army, Latino farm workers returned to the fields of California, and it's remarkable how little compassion and how little interest there's been in the plight of migrant farm workers ever since. And I would put to you that if the migrants of this state today had blonde hair and blue eyes, what's happening would not be tolerated or allowed. So what's happening? There has been a huge, huge increase in illegal immigration and the exploitation of illegal immigrants over the last 20 years. And there's been a real drop in wages. In some parts of the farm economy, wages adjusted for inflation have fallen 50%. Now, there was a moment in California in the 1970s when farm workers were actually earning a decent wage and getting benefits, thanks to the efforts of the United Farm Workers Union. And then under Governor Duke Majan, starting in 1980, enforcement of the labor laws was relaxed. The growers brought in illegal immigrants, mainly from Oaxaca, to use them as strikebreakers. The UFW was decimated, and wages plummeted. And bringing in workers from Oaxaca was a very, very clever tactic, because the Indians who live in Oaxaca are despised within Mexico. Many of them are non-Spanish speaking, speak pre-Columbian dialects. Most of the farm workers who were here already were mestizo, and it was a very clever way to pit one ethnic group against another. So some of the conditions that I found in California were just appalling. Terrible, terrible exploitation. And for all of you who like to eat really healthy food, as I do, almost all of those fresh fruits and vegetables must be picked by hand. And the increase in farm labor and the lowering of their wages in this state has been remarkable. Now, I write about this at some length, but in the afterword to this paperback edition, I write about the one place in the United States where I think things are worse right now, and that's the state of Florida. Florida, in the fields of Florida, things are unbelievably bad. And the reason they're so bad in Florida is Florida does not have a long tradition of Mexican and Latino immigration, so there isn't the same kind of support system. Florida has a long anti-union history, so there are absolutely no farm worker unions. Florida has a history of slavery and a long history of exploiting the people at the very bottom. And right now, Florida has a Bush as governor. And Governor Jeb Bush is very close with the agricultural interests of that state. And so the abuses are going unprosecuted by the state. And the federal government has now had to step in. The U.S. Justice Department has now stepped in 6 times to prosecute cases of slavery in Florida. And you know, if there are 6 cases that have been successfully prosecuted, there are many, many others that are going unknown and undetected. I'm just going to read you a couple of examples of these slavery cases in Florida that the state government has done nothing to prevent. What's happening is illegal immigrants are being brought in debt. Their smugglers are selling the debt to the labor contractors. The labor contractors keep the immigrants in debt, charging them for food, transportation, tools, et cetera, and often holding them at gunpoint and locking them with chains into trailers until they pay off their debt. And here are some of the punishments that you get. Abel Coelho Jr., part of a group that held at least 20 migrants until their smuggling debts were repaid, pled guilty to peonage and received a 33-month sentence. 33, that's less than 3 years. Some of the migrants in the case were told they'd be shot if they tried to escape. Coelho served his time and has since been released from prison. Michael Allen Lee recruited migrants at homeless shelters in Florida, charged them for room, board, transportation, and cigarettes, loaded them with debt, gave them as little as $10 for a day's work in the fields, sometimes paid them in crack cocaine and alcohol instead of cash, and threatened to hurt anyone who ran off. Lee severely beat one farm worker, George E. Williams, and then made him scrub his own blood off the walls. In August 2001, a federal judge sentenced Lee to 4 years in prison, 4 years for slavery, after a plea bargain. Had Lee been convicted in the same court for growing 100 marijuana plants, he would have faced a longer sentence, a mandatory minimum of 5 years. So, slavery in America in 2004. And I try very hard in this section not to demonize illegal immigrants, not to encourage any kind of anti-immigrant sentiment. The reality is these people are being actively recruited because they are the poorest and most vulnerable, the most unlikely to join unions, the most unlikely to complain about working conditions, the most unlikely to complain about overtime violations. And this system was perfected in California, but in Fast Food Nation, my other book, I wrote about meatpacking and how meatpacking used to be one of the highest paid industrial jobs in the United States. It was a job that provided a decent middle class living until recent immigrants and illegal immigrants were recruited and used as strikebreakers. And meatpacking is now one of the lowest paid industrial jobs in the United States with one of the highest turnover rates. We are now seeing the same thing in construction, in textiles. Walmart, the nation's largest employer, has been caught with illegal immigrants cleaning its stores 7 days a week for subminimum wages. So this system is spreading throughout the United States. I'm going to read you now a passage that every time I read it, it still strikes me, the experience of being there. And this is a passage about some migrant farm workers that I visited in northern San Diego County. Now, northern San Diego County is unusual in that about a third of the migrant workers are homeless. And accompanied by their family members, they make up a population of about 15,000 to 20,000 that's living in the hillsides. Now, they used to live in shanty towns that were out in the open until local white youths would raid the shanty towns and beat them up in what were called beaner raids. And in order to avoid being beaten up and in order to avoid detection and arrest by the immigration authorities, these migrants have moved into the hillsides, into encampments that are very cleverly hidden. Some of them are not far at all from gated communities where the houses cost many millions of dollars each. So this is my visit to one of the migrant worker encampments in northern San Diego County. At the end of a driveway near a chain-link fence, I met a young Mixtec Indian from Oaxaca who lived in one of these encampments. His name was Francisco, and he was 18 years old. He looked deeply exhausted. He had just picked strawberries for 12 hours at a nearby farm. I asked what he thought of his boss. "Not bad," he said politely. The previous year, Francisco had picked strawberries from April until July. He had saved $800 during that period and had wired all of it to his mother and his father in the village of San Sebastian Tecomaxhuaca in Oaxaca. This was Francisco's second season in the fields, but he hadn't gotten to see much of San Diego County. He was too afraid of getting caught. So his days were spent at the farm, his nights at this encampment. He picked strawberries 6 days a week, sometimes seven, for 10 to 12 hours a day. "When there's work," Francisco said, "you have to work." Every morning he woke up around 4:30 and walked half an hour to reach the fields. At dusk, 13 tired men in dirty work clothes approached us. They were all from Francisco's village in Oaxaca. They worked together at this farm and stayed at the same encampment at night. They knew one another's families back home and looked after one another here. The oldest was 43, and the youngest looked about 15. All of these men were illegal immigrants. All of them were sick with coughs, but none of them dared to see a doctor. As the sun dropped behind the hills, clouds of mosquitoes descended upon us, and yet these migrants seemed too tired to notice. They lay on their backs, on their sides, resting on the hard ground as though it were a sofa. Francisco offered to show me their encampment. We squeezed through a hole in the chain-link fence and through gaps in rusting barbed wire and climbed a winding path enclosed by tall bushes. It felt like a medieval maze. As we neared the camp, I noticed beer cans and food wrappers littering the ground. We came upon the first shack, short and low, more like a tent, just silver garbage bags draped over a wooden frame. A little farther up the path stood three more shacks in a small clearing. They were built of plywood and camouflaged. Branches and leaves had been piled on their roofs. The landowner didn't know that the migrants lived here, and this encampment would be difficult to find. These migrants were hiding out like criminals or Viet Cong. Garbage was strewn everywhere. Francisco pointed to his shack, which was about 5 feet high, 5 feet wide, and 7 feet long. He shared it with two other men. He had a good blanket, but when it rained at night, the roof leaked, and the men would have to go to work soaking wet the next day and dry off in the sun. Francisco had never lived this way before coming to San Diego. At home, in Oaxaca, he always slept in a bed. Driving back to my motel that night, I thought about the people of Orange County, one of the richest counties in the United States, big on family values, yet bankrupt from financial speculation, unwilling to raise taxes to pay for their own children's education, unwilling to pay off their debts, whining about the injustice of it, and blaming all their problems on illegal immigrants. And I thought about Francisco, their boogeyman, their scapegoat, working 10 hours a day at one of the hardest jobs imaginable and sleeping on the ground every night for months so that he could save money and send it home to his parents. We have been told for years to bow down before the market. We have placed our faith in the laws of supply and demand. What has been forgotten or ignored is that the market rewards only efficiency. Every other human value gets in its way. The market will drive wages down like water until they reach the lowest possible level. Today, that level is being set, not in Washington, D.C., or in New York City, or in Sacramento, but in the fields of Baja California and the mountain villages of Oaxaca. That level is about $5 a day. It's the going wage in Oaxaca, $5 a day. No deity that men have ever worshipped is more ruthless and more hollow than the free market unchecked, and there is no reason why shanty towns should not appear on the outskirts of every American city. All those who now consider themselves devotees of the market should take a good look at what is happening in California. Left to its own devices, the free market always seeks a workforce that is hungry, desperate, and cheap, a workforce that is anything but free. Now, again and again, the free market is used as an excuse for these conditions and a justification for these conditions. And I would put to you that there is nothing inevitable about these conditions. The Florida farm workers who are fighting against slavery are trying to organize under a group called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Their demand is an extra penny per pound of tomatoes. The UFW is currently doing a campaign in the strawberry industry. The UFW campaign is not asking for all the strawberry farms to be seized and their assets given over to the workers in workers' collectives. The UFW is asking for a nickel per pint, an extra nickel per pint of strawberries. These are trivial sums. I did a calculation of what would eliminate poverty among the migrant workers of America, the poorest workers in America. It would cost the typical American household an additional $30 to $50 in their food bill. And it's probably more likely $30. Now, it's not happening because of an unwillingness to intervene in the market on behalf of workers. The minimum wage today is lower than it was 50 years ago, adjusted for inflation. It's about 30-35% lower than it was in the late 60s, adjusted for inflation. The last time it was raised was 1997, and it's about 15% lower than it was then. And the unwillingness to intervene in the market on behalf of the poorest workers in this society is very difficult for me to take. My background is in American history. And when I look at the history of this country and how we developed economically, I have to tell you, it didn't have very much to do with a free market. We began as a slave-holding country. Slavery is a contradiction of the free market. That's what built up our agricultural surpluses. That's what built up this country until the Civil War. And after the Civil War, we became a manufacturing powerhouse. And how we became a manufacturing powerhouse had nothing to do with the free market, and everything to do with a protective tariff placed on imported goods that protected American factory owners from competition. Now, the great 19th century form of transportation was the railroads, crucial to linking this country together as an economic unit. How were they built? Had absolutely nothing to do with the free market. The federal government gave millions of acres of land that belonged to everyone in the United States to the railway companies. And those companies were then able to hold on to the land or sell the land to fund the building of the railways. And a lot of railroad companies are more real estate companies today than they are actual railways. In Fast Food Nation, I write about the next great form of transportation, the automobile industry. The triumph of the automobile industry had nothing to do with the free market and everything to do with government spending to build roads. If GM and Ford had to build the roads for the automobiles they make to drive on, there wouldn't be very many cars. The biggest public works project in American history is the building of the interstate highway system at a cost of almost $400 billion. It's a direct subsidy, not just to the automobile industry, but to the oil industry. The airline industry couldn't carry passengers profitably, barely existed until the U.S. government decided that instead of having its own government planes to carry the mail, airmail would be carried on the airlines, on private airliners, and it was U.S. government money that built Delta and Eastern and Pan Am and all of our airlines. You look at the heart of the 21st century economy, the Internet. The Internet was created at the Defense Department, subsidized by the Defense Department for years before private industry had anything to do with it. And when you turn on the water tonight, when you go home, think about where that water came from, how it was brought to your tap in this state, and how California agriculture, the number one industry in this state, gets its water. There are a few dams here that were built by government. So when you start looking closely, the government is intervening in the economy every single day. And I think that's good. I think there are ways the government can intervene, like building roads and subsidizing high tech. That's very good for this economy. But if it's going to intervene on behalf of these industries, it can also intervene on behalf of the poorest, weakest people in this society. And that shouldn't be seen as a sacrilege to say it should be done. Now, when you look at countries that have a big black market, and I told you earlier, ours is growing, you find that they have very high levels of corruption and very, very wide gaps between the rich and the poor. And I would argue that there are all kinds of very selfish interests why all of us should care what's happening to the poorest and the weakest. Because as societies get more and more stratified, they become more and more unstable. And no matter how wealthy you are, the gates eventually aren't high enough and aren't strong enough. And there's no shortage of people, very wealthy people, who had to flee other countries and come here because of the incredible gulf between rich and poor. But I said there's also, I'm going to end on a religious note, and so here is my own attempt to introduce religion into the political life. All of the great religious traditions have at their core, helping the weak and the poor. Again, in our society for the last 20 years, it's been derided and ridiculed. But if you go back to the origins of these religions, that's how they start. The Old Testament, in Psalms, give justice to the weak and the fatherless, maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute, rescue the needy. The New Testament, Jesus' first words in public, according to Luke, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the good news to the poor. Jesus' ministry was devoted to the poor. As he says in Matthew, we will be judged by how we respond to the hungry, the thirsty, and the stranger. Now, the stranger is a biblical term for the immigrant. In Islam, every devout Muslim must pay the zakat, an obligatory tax devoted to helping the poor. And in the Quran it says, true piety is to believe in God and to give one's substance to the needy, the traveler, again, an immigrant, beggars, and to ransom off the slave. Even Buddhism, which you would think would be fundamentally detached and removed from this issue, has in recent years become engaged in social justice. And it may sound like a contradiction in terms, but there is a movement now called Engaged Buddhism, and I'm all in favor of it. And I'm going to end by reading you a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh, a Vietnamese monk and a great advocate of Engaged Buddhism. Quote, once there is seeing, there must be acting. Otherwise, what's the point of seeing? Thank you.
That was Eric Schlosser speaking last April in Santa Barbara, California. Thanks to the LA Sound Posse who produced this talk for radio. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.